Welcome to Dancin' Moon Songcast. I'm Scott Simpson, casting from Dancin' Moon Studio in Spearfish Canyon on the north end of the Black Hills of South Dakota, right on the banks of the Spearfish Creek. If you'd like to follow along, you can download a free PDF of my lyric book from scottsimpsonmusic.com/lyrics. And of course, you can find links to all my music there as well. So let's get casting and find out what song we're going to talk about this time. Well, I hope you're okay with something a little bit different. As you know, if you are a regular listener, and especially if you have been listening in sequence, we've just finished a 12-episode series on songs from my new 2020 album, Ozzy's Guitar 20 Years Later, and the song that it was, or the album that it was in tribute to, the 2000 album, my first one, Ozzy's Guitar. We just finished 12 episodes looking at those 12 songs. And as I've mentioned before, we have coming up in January 2021 a brand new album that I am super excited about. And I will, in all probability, be doing a series similar to the one we just finished, but addressing those 12 songs, the new songs on the new 2021 album, Keys to My Head. But we have a few weeks in between. And so I've been struggling about what to do with those. We could go back to what we did the entire first year of our podcast, which is to dig back into songs over the really the 28 albums that I have put out over the last 20 years, and we could do that. But I thought, you know, there's something I've been wanting to do that I haven't done. And I'll take just a few minutes to explain it to you, and then we'll do it and see how it goes. So you may or may not know, and probably you don't know. You know I'm a songwriter, and I talk about that. I've been producing as an indie producer in my own studio for 20 years. Now, since about 2000 songs, putting out now will soon be 29 albums. I was making songs and writing songs before that. Certainly, I've been writing songs honestly since I was probably 6 or 5 or 7 or I don't know, something like that. But the other thing that is important, I think, for you to know about this new little episodic series that we're going to do is that I'm also a poet. And up until the year around 2009, that was a huge, huge focus for me. And by huge focus, I mean that's what my PhD is in, creative writing, specifically poetry. And so I am a published poet and was even nominated for a Pushcart Prize in the year 2000, which is really awesome. I didn't win a Pushcart Prize, but it's, you know, as they say, it's an honor just to be nominated. I have taught creative writing and poetry writing courses in at least 4 or 5 different colleges or universities that I can count. Have done creative writing workshops, have been on the editorial staff of a couple of different publications. And so that's a huge piece of who I am. And it's not unconnected with the songwriting. In fact, in my mind, they're very connected. But around the year 2009, I did sort of consciously make a decision to a large degree, to back away from the poetry writing and specifically back away from pursuing publication and those sorts of things in the realm of poetry and move fully as my creative outlet into indie producing and songwriting and music composition and things like that. A big piece of that story had come earlier, a few years earlier, and I think I may have alluded to this in episodes in the past. But I was employed in higher education, which I am not at the present. I'm employed otherwise. I do a lot of work for a group that works with K-12, and that I taught in high school for many years before I went into higher ed. But as you know, in higher ed, there was a push to publish or perish, and that's fine. I understand that. But in some institutions, not all, but in some institutions, that leaves the poets and the artists in a bit of a quandary sometimes, because there's a bias toward research. And I'm not against research. I understand research. I value deeply research, whatever kind of research that might be. But the creation of poetry or fiction or any sort of art form, the creation of music, the creation of visual arts, performing arts, those aren't research. Those are creative works, aesthetic works. And so the publication of those sorts of things looks a little different than the kind of peer-reviewed, the sort of peer-reviewed research writing that occurs and is valued in many ways and validly valued in many universities. So my experience personally in higher ed was a negative one in respect to my creative work. In that, not that I was not being published, and not even that my publications weren't valid or even peer reviewed as far as creative works and poetry goes, but they weren't valued in the same way that a big research project might be valued. And so my experience and part of what got me out of higher ed teaching, and part of what eventually led to my abandoning, to some degree, my deeply felt pursuit of poetry and poetry publication, was the pain of that, of being in an institution that frankly said, you know, big stack of poems, it'd take a huge stack of poems to be worth one research article. So, all of that said, it felt like a kick in the gut. And I'm not naming names or institutions. But what I did do in 2009 is I had been really focused on poetry writing since the beginning of, well, really college, but in a very serious way since about 1989 up through 2009. It was a 20-year mark that felt kind of monumental. And so I put together, not published, but put together a collection of selected poems from that time period. That includes poems that never appeared anywhere. It also includes some poems that were a part of my doctoral dissertation. It includes poems that were published. It also includes poems that were the poem that got me nominated for the Pushcart Prize, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Boy, that was a long way around to tell you that we're going to do a brief series here in the intervening time, I think, unless it starts feeling like this isn't what I ought to be doing, and then I'm always ready to change course. We're going to do a brief series, Dance and Moon Songcast poetry series. And so what I'm going to do, I have a digital version of that selected poems from 1989 to 2009, and I'm going to be pulling out a poem each episode and giving voice to it, doing a reading, not explaining it so much as giving a context for it, maybe musing over it afterwards, talking a little bit about what's going on, maybe what I, how I see that. All these poems, I don't know precisely the circumstance of the writing of all of them. There are a whole lot of poems, and you're not going to hear most of them. But I will try to talk about each poem and kind of give some context maybe after the reading of the poem. I do want to do this, though. I want to give just in this episode maybe just slightly longer, and because I do want to take just a few moments to talk about poetry, because poetry is not something that everybody is really familiar with. You know, in my PhD, it was a PhD in creative writing, specifically poetry, but it was also, I had to have a focus on modern American and British poets, also Great Plains poets. And so I did a lot of study around poetry and a lot of thinking around what is happening in poetry and what is poetry trying to do. And so in a real brief sense, I'm going to read a short poem that is one of mine coming from this collection. It's the first one that we'll read. I'm going to read that and use it as a jumping off place to make a couple of points about poetry and what it's trying to do and what it is and what it isn't. And then we'll go into the specific poem for this episode that we're going to take a look at. So I hope you'll stick with me. I feel like this is important for me. It's important. It also puts me in a very vulnerable place. For some reason, I feel much more vulnerable about my poetry than I do about my song. That's probably why I've been cranking out the songs and not writing so much poetry. I maybe felt a little too vulnerable to get into that mode. But here we go. I'm stepping out. So we'll take a listen to this really brief poem, and then I'll talk a little bit about poetry in general based on this poem, and then we'll take a listen to, I'll read the poem that I've selected for this episode. So this brief poem, introductory poem, is called I Don't Need Poetry. I don't need poetry. I don't need poetry unless it scratches secretly on my window. I open the door to discover it was only wind. I don't need poetry unless it doesn't want my observation anymore. When I lower my eyes, it stretches great wings across the sky. I don't need poetry, and I say that with the best intentions. I retract it when it lies cold in my hands. I don't need poetry unless it slopes up along the edges so the heaviest words get trapped when it begins to spin. I need poetry like I need a small white dove winging hither an olive garnish for this silver platter beneath my chin. Okay, so we begin our poetry series with a poem that says, I don't need poetry. But what this poem represents, I think, and the point I want to make is that, unlike the lay definition of poetry, well, it has a rhythm and it rhymes. Okay, maybe poems have rhythm and rhyme. Sometimes they do. In the past, quite often they did. But what is poetry trying to do right now in the modern times and in the postmodern times? What is poetry trying to do? A great poet, Kenneth Koch, who passed away, I believe, just a few years ago, wrote a lot about what poetry was trying to do. And this is my take on Kenneth Koch's perception. Poetry is trying to communicate something that goes beyond the prose language that we use. Okay, prose is language that is not poetry. It's the, you know, it's the other thing. Okay, so if I need to make a grocery list, or I need to explain instructions on doing something, or I need to write a letter to a friend, okay, I do that in prose. And what I'm doing with my language is I'm trying to communicate fairly straightforwardly certain things, and I'm trying to word things clearly so that they understand what I'm trying to say, and it does a really important work. It does great work, in fact. It gets amazing amounts of information, specific information across. It's remarkable what language does. Occasionally, let's admit, prose can become poetic. And in that sense, it might be poetry. The sense that I get from reading this letter from my good friend takes me to a place that is beyond just those words, gives me an understanding or a perception or a vision that is much more than simply the information on the page. That goes beyond prose. It goes into poetry. Well, that's what poetry is trying to do, and it's trying to do it any way it can. Poetry is trying to communicate something by using the vehicle of language, but not just in that prosaic way. Poetry is trying to, and it may use rhythm, and it may use rhyme. It definitely uses sound. The sounds become important. The rhythms become important, more important than they are in prose. But also, the way the words are put together, the sort of meaning that words make together, or even the sort of meaning they don't make, when you juxtapose two words that don't seem like they ought to go together, that's something that you do in a poem. A poem is trying to communicate beyond and above the prosaic use of language. And so, therefore, just like with modern art, folks who are used to dealing with language, prose, straight up prose, get a little frustrated and confused sometimes with poetry, especially modern and postmodern poetry that may be doing things that are just not done with prose. You're not going to get the same thing that you would get in a letter. Now, sometimes you might, because sometimes what the poet is doing is the poet, and William Carlos Williams was wonderful with this, trying to take the mundane, the regular prose, and lift it to a place where it is being heard and perceived and understood in a much higher way, in a poetic way, so that there is more than just what seems to be there on the page, by presenting something that might be prose in a poetic form, and asking the reader to get something much more than just the prose meaning, the prosaic sense of it. So all of that's to say, these will sound different than my songs. My songs, if you read the lyrics to my songs, here's sort of my philosophy with song lyric. You got to realize these words are going along with a whole nother set of meanings, which are all those notes and those rhythms that are embedded in the music and the instrumentation and all of that. So to give someone something extremely complex language-wise, alongside and embedded within something that is already very complex, the music, it's going to be lost. It's going to be lost. You know it as well as I do. Most people listen first to the music, and then what they catch or what they pick up from the lyric helps to support that, helps build it, helps to make it even more significant. But first and foremost, people listen, when they listen to a song, they listen to the music. And then if they really fall in love with a song, that's when they like pull out the lyric sheet and study the lyrics and go, oh my gosh, I didn't realize it was saying that. Oh, wow, that makes it even more meaningful. Or, oh, I didn't know it said that. Oh, wow, I thought I liked that song. That's kind of stupid. Or whatever. But the bottom line is a good song does something with language a little different than poetry does. Okay? So what I'd like to ask you to do then is to begin, especially in this series. You'll be listening to my poetry, and it's going to be coming from different time periods between 89 and 2009, and it's going to be different styles and different approaches and different things that I was trying to do. What I'd like you to do is open your mind beyond the prose. Open your mind beyond the prose meaning of things. And be prepared to see where not only the language, not only the words, but the sense and the nonsense and the sound, see where it takes you, image-wise, connections-wise. What connections does it make for you? And then I will try to talk a little bit after I read each poem. I'll talk a little bit about you know, maybe a little bit about what's going on. I'm not going to explain the poem. I don't know that I could sometimes, because if I could explain it, then why not just explain it in prose? That's why I did the poem, because I'm trying to get at something that is really difficult to get at in straight up prose. So we'll begin with our first poem in the series. The title of the poem is Quoting Robert Burns. Robert Burns was a Scottish poet. Quoting Robert Burns. It began with the woman in the commercial. She had dirty socks. Her boy had played baseball in the mud, as all American boys do. We had turned the set on, leaving the room to do our other business and leaving it to its covertly explicit ramblings, when suddenly, childlike, precipient, she began quoting Burns without a brogue, like making faces in the car on the highway without adjusting the rearview mirror to see them anymore. Doing the thing just to do it, not to keep sane on a long trip or try out different smiles to use in public or to sell detergent. Of course, I was not there. Otherwise, it would have been tainted, as all commercials are, having more to do with a fat man in the biggest office than with clean socks or American boys, who, of course, played baseball in the mud. It was night. Over the rows of dry cornstalk arms broken into elbows just above the surface, snow was the promise for that night, and my truck whined down the highway, either side black as the edge of a mattress, until a glowing greenhouse emerged, orange in the starboard vastness of dead fields. Life was there. Roses, mums, zinnias, tulips, perhaps even strawberries or beans. In the darkness, the elbows shuddered beneath the first flakes. As I turned off the radio, I believe my face glowed dimly in the mirror by the dashboard lights. Life was there. The snow came secretly later that night, rendering the stock arms overtly implicit within the whiteness, symbol of the housewife with a million dirty socks, and no more commercial to let her know. Quoting Burns without a brogue, giving up on the impossible purity of snow in anything too ulterior, too prepared. But no one heard the woman or the stocks movement. I make my faces alone, without even the eye of the mirror quoting Burns just because it's Burns. So, I chose this poem because it's one of the early ones. And I think I'll jump around and do an early one and then do a more recent one. But this is an early poem that felt like a breakthrough for me in dealing with some images and some language and trying to get at some ideas that are hard to get at. And I think there's some frustration with commercials, with ulterior motives, with agendas. And in this poem, there's this interesting idea that, and maybe this is an idea I've had since I was a kid. Does the TV still do what it's supposed to do if you leave the room? It's a little bit like, does a tree make a noise in the forest when it falls in the forest if there's no one there to hear it? If I leave the room, and the commercial about the mom who's trying to get the socks clean because her son plays baseball in the mud, if I leave the room and there's nobody in there, does she still talk about that? Or might she just break out into something else? Because there's no reason for her to continue trying to sell detergent if there's nobody there to listen, okay? And what if she just started quoting the poet Robert Burns? And of course, she's not Scottish, so she's not quoting him. And if you've ever read any Robert Burns, you know that the way it's written quite often, the Scottish brogue is like written right in, spelled into the words. But she can't do that because, you know, she's not Scottish. She's just an American mom, you know. But she goes into quoting Burns, poetry from Burns. And why would that happen? And what happens when we're not being observed? What happens to what we do when we don't have an audience anymore? And I think about this, and this is one of the reasons I want to choose this, because we're right here, right now, today, they're trying to figure out what the heck happened in this presidential election. So much communication, constantly by television, by Twitter, by everything else, by constantly, all of it, incredibly self-aware, with lots of motives, spinning the words for very specific purposes, for very specific audiences. And did we not get enough votes in this demographic? Well, it's because we didn't quite spin it the right way for that specific demographic. And there's all this ulterior stuff going on, all of these motives. And I think this poem in my mind asks the question, do we ever just do things to do them? Or is it always to impact this other audience, to put forth a particular image or a particular idea, to spin our own ego or our own, the way we are in a certain way to get a certain reaction or a certain outcome? Is there ever a time when we just do the thing, whatever the thing is, we just do it to do it? And there's a section there in the middle. And I lived in, at the time when I wrote this, I was living in York, Nebraska, and I was doing graduate work in Lincoln, which is 45 minutes away on Interstate 80. And in the wintertime and in any time, it's wide open cornfields, okay? And so this is an image from driving down Interstate 80 in the middle of the night, as the snow is just beginning to start, and it's all so dark. Like the black as the edge of a mattress is the line. either side, black as the edge of a mat. You ever been, and when you were a little kid, laying on your mattress, and you look, and I know this is a little bit of a stereotype, but you look over to the edge, and it's dark. It's black off the side of the bed on that side. It's black off the side, and that's where the monsters are. That's where the frightening stuff is. That's where you're scared to swing around. If you need to go to the bathroom or get a drink of water, you're scared to swing your legs down off, because what's down there? What's under the bed? What's down beside in the dark? Okay. But this glowing greenhouse emerged, and this really happened to me. There are some greenhouses out there in the middle of the cornfields. I don't understand it, but when you have a greenhouse and for whatever reason lit up on the inside at night, so there's this glow, and you wonder what's going on over there. Because no one's looking. It's not done for somebody. It's not to make a certain impact. Something is happening over there, and it has to do with life. Life was there. Roses, mums, zinnias, tulips, maybe strawberries and beans. And as the snow begins to, sorry, my dogs are barking. As the snow begins to fall outside on these dead cornstalk arms that have been broken off and bent over, and they're out there in these fields that are now just being covered with snow. Life is happening inside this greenhouse. And so you wonder, what happens with life when life is just happening, not to be seen, not with an agenda, not with a purpose to change something, to do something to somebody else, to cast itself in a particular light or to sell something. What happens? What is that like? Does that happen? How often does that happen? Or is everything just ulterior? Is everything agenda-driven? Because sometimes it feels like that. It feels like everything's agenda. You wonder if when you go on Facebook or when you go on social media, is anyone doing something that's real, or are they all just doing something to get your reaction, to impress you, to cause you to think this about them? And then the question, to what degree is that okay? To what degree is it just a wonderfully fresh thing to have life just happen with no motive, just things doing what they do? The trees, the grass, the dogs, you know. My dog is barking right now, not to get my attention, I think. Just because the dog saw a squirrel outside, I'm sure. And it's excited about that. So, why did Burns come in? I think because it was just a strange connection. I think for a woman, an American woman, American mom selling detergent in a commercial, to suddenly break out into quoting Robert Burns, but she can't quite do the accent. You know, I think that's what poetry does. It juxtaposes a couple of strange things and asks you to make sense of that. So there we have it, our first in a series of Dancing Moon Songcast poetry episodes, quoting Robert Burns by yours truly. And we started out, of course, with the shorter poem, I Don't Need Poetry. I hope you'll continue to join me for this. I hope maybe if you're excited about it, I hope you'll really enjoy this part, and maybe you can let me know. If you want to read the poems and see them, I will be posting those on the podcast page, which is at scottsimpsonmusic.podbean.com. Okay, and so you can find that there, and I'll post both of these poems there, And I hope you'll continue to join. And if you know somebody who's interested in poetry, who might like this, you know, there's not a lot of music going on here, except at the beginning and the end. Although maybe after I finish this up, maybe I'll just lay a little bit of gentle music underneath. That might be nice. We'll try that out. Invite them to come and join us for this podcast series on specifically poetry. We'll probably do this for a few weeks and see how it goes. And then, of course, we'll remind you about the brand new album that's coming up. Super excited about it. Keys to My Head. Of course, by the time you've listened to a lot of my poetry, you're probably going to have the keys to my head. You'll have me all figured out. You can write me and let me know about that, too. So you can find all my music, all my lyrics at scottsimpsonmusic.com. Stream all the songs on Spotify, on iHeartRadio, or on Apple Music and iTunes. And thank you for joining me, and I hope you'll enjoy these new episodes around my poetry from 1989 to 2009. Be well.